The next case is 97-1904, Columbus Bar Association versus Lewis William Dye.
Supplement, and I'd like to go right to what I think is the issue, or I want to be sure is the issue. Are we talking here about penalty? The board says 2 years, the panel said 2 years, I think, and 1 year stayed. And is that what you're seeking? Okay, so you're seeking just a reduction of the penalty that the board recommends.
What we're seeking is that this panel give deference to the panel that originally recommended.
That said 2 years suspended, 1 year stayed.
Okay. There is no question that mistakes were made and that Lewis Dye exercised a bad judgment over what was essentially a fee dispute. What started out as a fee dispute was somehow or another given to the Columbus Bar Association, and in correspondence from counsel for the Columbus Bar Association, prior to filings, it was noted that Mr. Dye represented Vicki Stringer and her brother, that he had earned fees from that tuition fund given by Vicki Stringer for representing the brother. Further, I may quote, "It is the suggestion of the committee to avoid any ethical violation. You calculate the amount of money that you have earned in return for the balance of the money to Vicki Stringer." Further in that same correspondence, "Based on the 401 recommendation, the committee has decided that if you resolve your difficulties by returning that portion of the unearned fee, there is no ethical violation." What we are dealing with here is what started out as a fee dispute, perhaps an arbitrated, mediated, and went beyond that. I would like to leave the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Wait, you say it went beyond that. You do then, you say it was just a fee dispute, but it went beyond that. Are you, by saying that you would agree that there should be at least a 1 year suspension, aren't you admitting that there was wrongdoing?
Yes, I would agree that there was bad judgment.
Okay.
Well, the bad judgment was that, I'm sorry.
Are you admitting that there was wrongdoing?
Yes,
sir. Okay. What was that?
The wrongdoing, in my view, was that once there started, the client requested that this money be returned, it should have been addressed immediately instead of going forward.
So the conflict is not in your mind, any wrongdoing there?
There, if I may, what I have been told and what I have learned is that originally what had happened here, there was not going to be any testimony of one against the other.
Yeah, I read that, and So you're saying that maybe there wasn't a conflict, that's just the allegation?
I'm sorry?
You're saying there maybe was not a conflict, that's just the allegation? All right, if it resulted in a conflict, then there were two things, the conflict plus the non-return of the $25,000.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cecil. Mr. Campbell.
Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, Cecil, former Justice Wright. This case, the later believes, involves two distinct strains of unprofessional conduct. The first arose from greed, and the second arose from disloyalty. They are both troubling. Taken together, they represent a pattern of behavior that this court and the legal profession simply cannot ignore. As the first of these strains, Respondent Plum, he still claims to a substantial amount of money that he was paid to represent one person. Under the guise of representing yet another person, despite all the evidence of contrary, he had no such agreement with the person who paid the money originally. This is not just a fee dispute. This is a matter basic honesty. Regarding the second strain, the respondent in what he now characterized, or at least in his brief characterized, as an attempt to protect his own good name. Said to that court that his former client was perhaps mentally unstable based on his observations of her, and that she was presenting to the government, to the court, or about to different version of facts than the one that she had portrayed to him while he was representing her. The relator is somewhat confused by the exact scope of the respondent's objections to this case. There seems to be a dissonance between his explicit acknowledgement that the court's finding was correct and his attempt then in his brief to suggest that some of those findings were flawed. What he seems to be
counsel, I want to back up a second. There are this representation from the court that the lawyer's perception may be required to be really unstable. What's specific other professional conduct that violated?
If during the course of the attorney-client communications that he had with Vicki Stricker, based on what she said to him, based upon saw, felt that she was mentally unstable, and then he communicated that fact in court of law in front of the very people who would challenge her as a witness in the government's case, and against her better interest in becoming an effective witness for them, we believe that substantially violated the reason she was becoming a government witness was to prove substantial cooperation. which would have an effect on her sentence. The judge, obviously, is the one who was going to make a decision about that. So even in chambers, I think a remark like that is improper.
Okay, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding how that is necessarily against interest or is it a sympathetic thing. I mean, certainly lawyers tell judges on a regular basis, my client's got a short fuse, you know, sort of give the judge a heads up before you get in the courtroom. That's improper behavior, I think.
Well, it's very clear that Vicki Stringer and her counsel did not take that as a kindly statement. And the fact that other counsel filed motions to have Vicki Stringer examined because of that statement would not suggest to me that it was taken kindly. What the respondent seems to be arguing here is that Holdsworth somehow didn't get the real flavor of the evidence that the panel heard. I would suggest that this argument ignores the process by which the court measures and reaches a decision. The court, of course, relies upon its panels to make findings of fact on weight of the evidence kinds of issues, but it does not have to accept conclusions of that particular panel about what the appropriate sanctioning recommendation ought to be. Let's remember that the panel is part of it. When the board deliberates, presumably the panel is there, there's give and take and exchange during that process, where it comes to consensus and presents that to this court. This is as it should be. Ultimately, of course, it's for this court to decide, given the wide sweep of cases that have been used, what the appropriate sanction is.
Mr. Campbell, can I go to the sanction now for a minute? That's what I'd like to do. If as part of the sanction, you started off, and I thought it was revealing when you said that the $25,000, he's still in possession of that he hasn't paid anything back. If part of our order includes restitution of the $25,000, would it be too onerous to make that payable through the Columbus Bar Association or through your office so that we know it was done? Because so often we get back here on these reports and they say, yeah, I'm making payments or I've made it, and then when we really check, it hasn't happened, and that's after the fact, and I'm just wondering if we could do that through your office. I've had good experience with your office.
Well, speaking of the Bar Association, we'd rather not have the money, Your Honor. I do think that a neutral source could be
okay.
The government probably will have claims upon this money. We are not here to
Well, who would you order restitution to?
Well, ultimately, the money, I suppose, would go to Vicki Stringer, subject to whatever claims the government might assert. And I believe that the U.S. government has ample means to protect its interests.
That's why I was asking the question, because obviously they will want to affect some lien on it.
We think that it's important to examine the posture of the respondent in these proceedings. He portrays himself, or has portrayed himself in his brief, as a merely misguided person who innocently violated the code. I would remind the court that the respondent had any number of occasions on which he could have realized the mistakes he was making and corrected them, including early on in the case when he spoke, sent him a letter, suggesting he ought to return the money. This was before the court hearing, by the way, and he chose not to avail himself of that opportunity. He also ignored warnings by at least two federal magistrates, and then the court proceeding itself, and still didn't return the money, and indeed so was not. It is clear that it was made abundantly clear early on in Vicki's murder. Certainly challenged his right to have his money. His ability to carry on as an independent counsel as a co-defendant, Rodney Stringer, was also brought to his attention early on in the case and should have served as a warning to him that trouble was ahead on that issue. Even by the asserting that what he does is justified on the whole. Respondent's contrition would seem to be lately arrived at and additional best. The respondent's medical documents, which have been presented to this court, were never presented in evidence for the panel, never subjected to the adversarial process, and frankly had no obvious connection to the events in this case. It is still our position that they should not be considered by this court. I won't rehearse for you the violation findings the court commissioners has made, unless the justice has asked us some questions about them. We do believe that given the seriousness of the respondent's failure to meet the mandates of the code, and given his prior disciplinary experience in this court, that he should be severely sanctioned. It has been our position throughout this case, and remains our position, that he should be indefinitely suspended. We believe that indefinite suspension would be consistent with prior decisions in this court, cited in our brief, particularly the Cincinnati Bar v. Stern case and the Cleveland Bar v. Fox case. Or at least, we believe the court should follow the recommendation of the full court.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Cecil, you saved 10 minutes of your time. Mr. Wright, can I argue for you? I didn't know that. Thank you. Sure. Even though you didn't sign in as being argued, you can argue.
I promise you this morning.
If he has no objection, you may argue.
Well, I know it's been a long morning, and I'll be mercifully brief. Frankly, I was surprised at the ferocity of Mr. Campbell's arguments, and I do note that he doesn't even mention the alleged divulging of attorney-client secrets. And I would refer the court to page 10 of the Holshue hearing, in which very briefly, she talked about her concerns about getting out of jail, her child, the situation, what kind of money to take from the bond. Never once, and this is the terrible thing, never once during the course of my two or three meetings with her did she ever admit any culpability of any sort or admit that she violated the law in any way, shape, or form. I suggest that's if a violation apparently was held and were conceded. It's a technical violation of the best. I'd like to address Justice Douglas's
counsel. I'm still trying to understand why that's a problem for her in her posture as to what she's turned the state's evidence.
At that time, it was Mr. Sherman who was in the back room who filed this complaint. Was considering, I think, pleading out and cooperating with the government.
It
was considering an advocate.
I guess I stopped because it wasn't that in the process of attorney state's evidence, she claims to know a lot about some illegal transactions, and so his statement that she denies any knowledge or culpability to him undermines her ability to try to deal with the prosecutors.
Your Honor, I guess the government didn't complain. The only one that complained about that was Mr. Sherman, who was involved in the Steeds deal. I'm not sure that I understand it myself. The board found a violation, but it's a technical violation. I said, if I represent somebody, and you're the trial judge, and I said, my client asserts her innocence. Well, technically, I suppose, unless the client agrees for him to say that, that may well be an attorney-client breach. But it's not very serious.
That's different if you're representing the client versus you no longer represent the client. Okay. You're representing a co-defendant, but right. Now you're sharing with the court what a co-defendant has told you. I see a very major difference there.
I agree, Justice. And that's why there is I think there's been an assertion of violation. However, it's not a. I also, I think that if I shared it with you as a trial judge, fact, my client told me that she's not guilty. Technically, that is an attorney-client statement.
But not guilty doesn't hurt her. The thing that
well, doesn't seem to me.
This seems like an egregious violation to me. Here's a lawyer who has a confidence about his client. She's dealing with the federal prosecutor, I guess it is, to get a reduced sentence or whatever. And he says, well, you can't. I was going to have a psychiatric exam of her. Well, that affects her credibility, I think, doesn't it?
That's another issue.
I think that's a terrible breach.
Let's speak like really said. Start with Jeff Wilson. By the way, we overruled the confidence issue. I have been forthright, I believe, in my recollection of the events. My first concern when I met was her psychiatric condition. I don't have a terribly large amount of experience with psychiatric patients, but she has had some severe problems.
He has volunteered that. I mean, this wasn't something that was generated by questions from the judge.
This was in the course of this disqualification. Conflict of interest proceeding, which Judge Holstu ruled against the government, and he was allowed to proceed. In any case,
was that in camera?
Pardon?
Was that in camera?
Yes.
Mr. Campbell says it was an open. Are we talking about two different things here?
I have the brief right here, on page 122 of the April 3rd, 1995 transcript. The court will note that Judge Holstu held a meeting, quotes, out of the hearing of open court. Yes, RX has said. The bulk of the conversation with Mr. Dodd occurred only in the presence of the judge, the prosecutor. And counsel for Vicki Stringer at a sidebar beyond the hearing of others.
Were the statements about...
However, it was in front of the state. It was in front of U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney. That was at a in-camera hearing.
And other defendants, or not?
They were back in the courtroom. They were at the bench.
So it was a sidebar rather than...
Yes, sidebar. Back and that's what was present. In any case, in our view, this case doesn't... Nothing more than the essence was a fee dispute, which rolled totally out of control and involved terrible judgment, and we could see that on the part of Mr. Dodd. We hope that the medical info, which is relevant to his state of mind during the course of the hearing itself, will temper the court's judgment. During the hearing, I'm sure you read the transcript, during the court panel, you can see Mr. Dye. Now, you know Mr. Dye, he's been in your court. He was just off the wall. The hearing reflects that. I'm sure you read that. We readily concede that M.S. Stringer's $25,000, at least in part, in whole, should be sent to either Mrs. Stringer or Ms. Stringer, Mr. Sherman, the Columbus Bar Association, where the funds have been placed in trust for that purpose. And that leads directly to your question, Justice Stokes. Mr. Campbell, of course, makes much of Mr. Dye's disclosure of quotes as client secrets and his offhand remark about his observations as to the motion stands. Now, the hope the court goes back and actually takes a look at this hearing before Judge Fulton. I am going to close now. I would like to argue rather vigorously that this court has consistently given a strong measure of deference to the panel who actually occurred and watched the participants here. I brought along with me some cases that I was going to discuss, and I know that the time has gone by. I would refer the court to Wright County v. Hendris, 74 Ohio State, Cincinnati v. Warren, Cincinnati Bar v. Warren, 66 Ohio State, and more recently, another case that dealt basically with the same sort of situation. Mr. Dock certainly deeply regrets that he didn't accept Mr. Swope's offer and send back $16,000 or $17,000 of this money back to the spring of 1995. He wouldn't be in all this agony if he'd used good judgment. And that's what
Where do we find in the record your reference to the $16,000 or $17,000?
That's Mr. Schwab's letter. Mr. Schwab has indicated the quotes, and right here. I'm not going to read it to you in total, but...
No, don't. If it's Mr. Swope's letter, and it's marked as an exhibit...
$6,500 that is owed Rodney by MS Stern, and the charge of every time to go in there hearing, and the bond hearing, and the three or four...
Never mind. I have my answer. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted, and you'll be advised to
sure is in the tank.
Marshal, please adjourn court.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. It's all the same. On the offspring of Ohio, now stands adjourned.